Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. Maybe you don't know him by name, but you definitely know my guest John Simon's work. A noted musician and songwriter in his own right, he produced and played on some of the most important albums of the 20th century, including records by Leonard Cohen, Simon & Garfunkel, Janis Joplin, and The Band. Simon's association with The Band is the occasion for our interview today, live at the Linda. He will be discussing his work with the group at a series of talks in the coming days. It's all part of the Egg's New York Living Legacy series focusing on The Band. John Simon will be speaking today at noon at the Albany Public Library, Saturday at Bethlehem Public Library and Guilderland Public Library, and Sunday at Saratoga Springs Public Library and Clifton Park Half Moon Public Library. John Simon, welcome to the Roundtable.
Hi, Ian.
you're up on stage here for our listeners behind a piano, and I thought you could start us off with a song.
Sure.
Just a child, the music in my head almost drove me wild. I didn't know what to do, I would lie awake nights, till one day I saw those black and whites. And ever since I got up on that piano stool, I've been a holy moly heart and soul-y piano playing fool. Piano's different in its special way. You never can tell until you sit down and play. Some play easy and some play rough. Either way, you know I can't get enough. Just like a monkey staring at a banana. That's me when I see a piano.
It's just me, but I want to give you a big round of applause. That was quite a way to start our segment. Thank you so much.
Thank you, E. When I say some pianos play easy and some play rough, this one plays rough.
What does that mean for a non-piano player?
Well, this is a question of some kind of immediacy between you and the instrument. I get used to getting a certain response out of an instrument that I play, usually the one I have at home, and if an instrument doesn't give you that back, if the keys are harder to play down or if they don't, it's complicated, but that's basically it.
Next time you have to bring your own.
Yeah, next time I'll bring my own. Right?
Can you tell that right away when you sit down at an instrument?
Pretty much, yeah, pretty much. But like I say, I'm a piano junkie. I'll play anything. I'm sort of a shy guy. If I go to a party and see a piano in the corner, I'll go to the piano rather than talk to people. And usually that brings people close to me, so that's a good thing anyway.
Was piano your first instrument?
Actually, violin was my first instrument, but it was so scratchy, my mom convinced my dad to shelve it and get me onto the piano instead.
Were you a practice hound? I mean, did you like practicing piano?
No, I'd rather go out and play ball with my friends. But I don't know, I always had a good ear, and so I could learn something at a piano lesson and then tell my piano teacher that I'd practice all week and then never look at it again until the next week and, you know, do all right with it. But as much as I love music, I've never had either the discipline or the natural chops to be a great piano player, either in a classical idiom or in a jazz idiom, like the great Oscar Peterson kind of level players, you know?
Well, when you first started out, were you learning classical or pop music?
I was first learning classical music, like every little kid learning my Mozart and before that, Clementi and Bach and Beethoven. And then when I was about 14, I said to my dad, can I please have a teacher who can teach me some popular stuff? So I got this great teacher in Norwalk, Connecticut, where I grew up, whose name was Andy Wirr. And he taught me, just a second. He taught me Boogie Woogie. And he taught me, I guess they call it stride piano, where one hand is doing this. So you could, that's just one hand. So with my other hand, I could play a melody like. That's Peg of My Heart, one of the first songs I ever learned. But like I say, this piano is funny. It's a beautiful, beautiful, elegant-looking, nice Yamaha piano, beautifully tuned. But it's not what I'm used to. I guess piano players get used to their instruments. That's the thing. When you're a horn player, you show up at a gig with your horn, and you're perfectly comfortable. Piano players are at the mercy of whatever instrument they find when they go someplace.
Because it's too hard to travel with it.
Yeah.
You can't bring your own.
Yeah. And I knew a guy. We're speaking of the band today, Stan Zelest, who was one of the piano players in what I call the reconstituted band after Robbie had left and they were all focused around Levon's studio in Woodstock.
It's about 1990 or so?
I'm not good with dates. I'll take your word for it.
Okay.
Richard Bell was the piano player. No, this is before Richard Bell. Richard Manuel was the piano player that he passed on, and Stan Zelest joined the group, which is the point of my story. So this is a beautiful piano in that it's brand new, but sometimes when you're a piano player on the road, you come across these pianos that are walking minefields. All the ivories have little nicks out of them, little jagged edges and little razor-like things on them, and you end up, if you have to do a gliss like that, you end up with a bloody thumb. So Stan had this great thing that he did. He took a soft pack of cigarettes, took all the cigarettes up, put the cigarette pack at the top of the piano up here, and whenever he had to do a gliss, he shoved his hand into the pack. And he could go back and forth all the time with no blood at all.
Are there other piano playing tricks like that? I've never heard that before.
I'm sure there are. None come to mind right away, no.
So what brings you here today is your series of talks about your association with the band. How did you get started having a career in the music industry to begin with?
Well, let's see. When I was in high school, a kid I hardly knew came up and said, I'm writing a musical that we're all going to do, and I want you to go and research and find some songs for us to do. And rather than research, I thought I'd write the songs because that was easier than researching them. So we wrote a show for my junior year in high school, another one for my senior year in high school, and on the basis of that, I got into Princeton University because they do these original shows that the students write every year and tour them. And so that my experience in high school was valuable for that. And I was just, you know, so into music. I'm such a compulsive musician. If I hear birds singing, I register what pitches they're singing. I'm just that way. If I'm in a restaurant and I'm having a conversation with somebody and a cool song comes on the sound system, my attention will go right to that song and I'll just miss all the conversation. But it's just the way things are with me. So when I was in college, back in those days, when you graduated, and this is hard to believe for young people today, you had job offers. You can believe that. And I had two job offers. One was to write commercials for an advertising agency, and the other one was to be a trainee at Columbia Records. And they each paid $85 a week. And so I took the Columbia Records when it sounded much more exciting. And, you know, I just started at the bottom of the totem pole and worked my way up. And I guess the turning point was when a guy came into my office with a demo of a song. And that's the way things were those days. There would be song pluggers or managers or people who would just be constantly coming through your office with an acetate of a song and play it for you, hoping you could hear something in it and hoping they could get some mileage out of it. This guy came in and he said he was Brian Epstein's American associate. Now, that carried a lot of weight with me because Brian Epstein was the Beatles manager. So I listened to what he played, and it was a decent song, and I went into my boss, and I, you know, got all my courage up because I was the youngest guy around there, and said, could I have, $2,000 to go in and make a record of this song? And he said, oh, son, take five. Here you go, you know. So we went in and made the record, and it was a Red Rubber Ball, and it was a pretty big hit. And so from that point on, they gave me other artists to do. They figured I had the secret, you know, that I knew how to do it. But it was just sort of, you know, there's a lot of luck involved, too.
And that's how you became a producer?
Yeah.
What is a producer? If someone's working on an album, what is a producer doing?
Well, a producer, first of all, is anybody. It can be a manager. It can be an arranger. It can be somebody in the band. It can be your spouse. It can be your best friend. It could be yourself. But one thing that all producers seem to have in common is we're all psychologists to some degree, because the artist has their whole creative output on the line there when they get in front of a microphone. They're understandably nervous about it, and they have to be guided through the process. The producer is somebody who goes from the idea of making a record to the actual record, somebody who supervises all that.
Did you find, because you worked with such a wide range of artists, did you find that when you got assigned to work with someone or ended up producing on an album, did you have to kind of subvert your own creative impulses to go with the idiom that artist was already in?
Yeah, that's a good question. Sure, that's part of the deal. I mean, either if you were a producer like Phil Spector or Brian Eno, then your creative idiosyncrasies will show up in the record. But basically, it's the artist's record. It's his name, his or her name is going to appear in the record. So the enlightened way to do it is to just be a servant to the project and just help it move along. At the same time, you know, my own thing that I want to accomplish is I'm an arranger and I'm a piano player. So I, if it's at all possible, try to arrange as much of the album as I can and play as much as I can.
I read you say somewhere else that you looked at yourself more from the songwriting background and arranging than the technical side. Like, as you mentioned, you weren't doing a Phil Spector wall of sound approach.
Oh, obviously. This is a microphone in front of me. I have no idea what it is. I do not want to know what it is. Ohms, volts, you know, come on. I've got enough to occupy myself with these things, you know?
How did you get hooked up working with the band? Tell us the story.
Well, one of my first jobs as an associate producer or assistant producer, whatever they called me, was to produce the jazz tenor saxophone player Charles Lloyd. And on one of those sessions, he brought in a young man named Robbie Robertson to play guitar. They had some friends in common. And I knew Robbie and met him at that point. Then, cut to several years later, after Bob Dylan had hired the band to be his backup band and had his motorcycle accident and kept them on a retainer in a little house in Saugerties that they called Big Pink. And they sat in that house there and worked up their own material. I had done some stuff for Peter Yarrow, one of Albert Grossman's clients. Albert Grossman was the manager of Dylan and Peter, Paul, and Mary, and so many others. And I had done a project with Peter, and I'd also produced Gordon Lightfoot, another one of Albert's clients. So Robbie decided to ask me if I wanted to be interested in producing the band. So he brought me up to Woodstock. And an interesting thing in the way history gets rewritten erroneously, Levon Helm arrived in Woodstock just a day before I did. And the Basement Tapes had already been recorded. So last year, when the Basement Tapes had their anniversary of some kind, everyone, I heard on the news, you know, like Charlie Rose on CBS saying, and there's Levon Helm with the Basement Tapes. Well, he wasn't even there, you know. The facts surrounding that are that before Bob had his accident and the guys in the band were his backup band, the act was being booed. Because Dylan had these pure folky fans and they didn't like his going electric. So they booed the band. And Levon didn't like being booed. So he left the operation and went back home to Arkansas. And a series of other drummers played for the subsequent tours with Dylan.
And then?
Then he came back the day before I came back. And the other guys had a bunch of songs, you know, in the works, pretty much together, and we all worked on them together, all six of us. And when we had enough to make a demo, we played them for Albert. He liked them. We went into the studio in New York City, an old studio at Columbia Records that I knew and loved so well, so I was really comfortable there. And we cut easily a third of the Big Pink album in one day there. Albert took the tapes out to Capitol in L.A., got us a deal. We went out to L.A., in January or so, in the middle of a Woodstock winter, went in the studio, checked out Capitol's famous studios at Hollywood and Vine, and I'll never forget the engineer there said, we asked him what he thought of the music, and he said, it's darn cute. That's what the engineer said of the band's music. It's darn cute. So that was sort of funny. But anyway, there we are in warm L.A. Well, back here in Woodstock, it's freezing. And we could have finished the album that day, but instead we just goofed off for a month in L.A. until Capitol Records said, aren't you guys out here to do a record? Okay. And so we went back and finished the record up.
For people like me who have made a pilgrimage to drive by Big Pink, what was that actually like inside with the band in the house?
Just a regular house occupied by a bunch of guys who were like bears in a house, you know, no regard for furniture.
They were messy.
I mean, one of my favorite stories is, I loved all these guys so much, but all of us humans have our slippings. You know, like I say, guys, the light went out in the bathroom of that house, so they grabbed a lamp from the living room and put it on the next to the sink in the bathroom so they had some light to brush their teeth by. So one day, Levon has a date there, and she gets up first in the morning, and there's a lampshade on the lamp, and she takes it off so she can see to put on her makeup better. Richard Manuel wakes up a little bit later in semi-stupor, and he's leaning and looking in his eyes in the mirror, and he starts to smell something burning. And he looks down and realizes it's his arm because he just had put it on top of a bare light bulb. So that's the kind of housekeeping that they did there.
Okay, for a certain age in life. While we're talking about this era, what do you make of Dylan winning the Nobel?
Well, it's great. What can I say? I've heard people say, you know, well, Philip Roth should have won. I've heard people say Leonard Cohen should have won. But, you know, you can't quarrel with Dylan's importance and with his poetry. There's a wonderful article about Leonard Cohen in The New Yorker a couple of weeks ago where he's talking to Bob, and Bob asked him how long it took him to write the particular song, and he said a number of years. And Leonard Cohen asked him how long it took Bob to write a certain song, and he said 15 minutes. So, I mean, genius comes in different forms, you know, and Bob has been so important to a whole generation of us, you know. He deserves awards.
Let's talk about the legacy of the band, which is the subject of all these egg events this year. Why do you think the music is still holding up? As someone who played, I think you played horns on one song I was reading.
I played piano on a little bit on each of the albums, and I played some horns with Garth on the albums. You know, the best way I can talk about that is the honesty of it and how different it was from the other music of the time. The other artists I worked with and other artists I knew would listen to the radio to listen to the hits and make sure that they were in on the trend and hopefully on the cutting edge of the trends. The guys in the band never listened to that kind of music. They listened to things that went way back. Early rock and roll, rockabilly, early bluegrass, early blues. It's even way back to Stephen Foster and music of the 19th century. Because I feel that they wanted to be part of this pantheon of legendary musicians and the music that they made. So they cared a lot about their music. And there's nothing trivial about the band's music. There was nothing thrown away about it. When the album of Big Pink came out, the first cut on the first side was not a loud and fast number like most bands would do for their debut album. It was Tears of Rage, which starts off, you know. We carried you in our arms on Independence Day. An octave higher than that, but it, you know, what a peaceful, deep song. Once again, a Bob Dylan lyric, a prize-winning lyric. And it just took all the musicians by surprise and by storm. It wasn't a big seller. It wasn't a big popular hit, but all these musicians around the world heard this and said, wait a minute, this is really American in a way that other music wasn't American. It had a heartland pioneer spirit about it, a roots spirit about it that wasn't artificial. It was really, as I say, trying to be part of that same genre. And it took such hold that you find Elton John's first album was all glam and glitz. His next album, he's got a big full beard and he's got a song in there called He Shall Be Leave On, or whatever that song was called. And bands who used to dress up in, you know, tight-fitting jackets and, you know, all spruced up and looking very, you know, teddy boyish, as they would say in England, all of a sudden now they look like farmers. And bands are out there with beards, and there was a lot of emulation at that point. I mean, also the Birds were starting to be like that, and the Burrito Brothers, and it spawned something which pretty quickly became known as Americana, and that didn't exist before the band. There wasn't a genre called Americana, so I think they had a really profound and lasting effect to this day.
Do you worry about the state of the art form of an album in 2016, where, you know, you go to YouTube to hear whatever song you're looking for? And
I try not to worry in general, Ian, but it's different. We used to program an album very carefully, you know, side one and side two, and the sequence was important. It was taking you on a trip. You know, to listen to an album was taking you on a trip. Now it's just tune by tune. And you can just, you know, hear of an artist and just go Google them and find one cut on YouTube that you like, and that's all you know about the artist. And that's about as deep as it goes until you go to a concert and hear their entire repertoire at a concert.
Well, I know you you brought a song to finish up with, so I'm going to announce your upcoming talks about the band. They start in just a couple of minutes at noon at the Albany Public Library, Saturday at Bethlehem Public Library and Gilderland Public Library, and then continuing Sunday at Saratoga Springs Public Library and Clifton Park Half Moon Public Library. And it's part of the Eggs New York Living Legacy series this fall, focusing on the band. What should we finish with?
Well, I thought I'd trot out this song because I went out on the road with the band for a while on their tour bus, and I discovered something that I thought was worthy of a song. So here it is. Well, this being on the road, you know, is really pretty swell. People take good care of you and try to treat you well. They'll even fix a meal for you to help you play and sing. But every night in every town, they fix the same old thing, eating chicken. Lead me to that buffet, screaming and a kicking. Too much grease to do my finger picking. All of that rib sticking chicken.
My lord, I swear altogether, I've had so many chickens I'm sprouting feathers. I'd sooner sit and watch my oatmeal thicken than eat another chicken, eat chicken. Drag me to that buffet screaming and a-kicking, the food for singing songs and politicking, all of that flea-flicking chicken. The chicken that we got on Monday, they used all day in a football game that Sunday. It was tough enough for passing and for kicking, but not for eating. No, 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 no eating chicken. Roll me to that buffet screaming and a-kicking, later lay me down burping and hicking, all from that mother frickin' chicken. Broiled, breaded, baked, or fried, no place to run, no place to hide. Excuse me, ma'am, I've had enough. I can't stand one more chicken puff or chicken wing or a la king or a la queen or else croquettes. Dinner, send my regrets. I'm feeling weird. I'm off my feet. I feel like chicken fricasseed. Chicken salad, chicken soup. I'd like to find me a chicken coop and set right down for a little bit. Maybe find me an egg and set on it.
Something like that.
John Simon, thanks for making our day and enjoy the talks in the region.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.